Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. When you think of bone, do you picture the human skeleton? Or perhaps you think of the bones we see in natural history museums, like those of dinosaurs or extinct large mammals. It's easy to think of bones as the girders of our bodies on which our flesh hangs, but that is oversimplistic. Bones, as you'll learn today, are dynamic tissues in a constant state of metabolic turnover and restoration, with specialized cells that both resorb and create new bone. Bone is highly evolved, as are specialized bones, such as our spines and skulls, which have developed over millennia to give us locomotion, consciousness, respiration, and digestion, all are supported and in communication with our other body systems. My guest today is author Riley Black, who's written a history and exploration of our bones called Skeleton Key, The Secret Life of Bone. Black is a journalist who's published in National Geographic, Scientific American, Wired, Slate, and The Wall Street Journal, among many others. One of her previous books, My Beloved Brontosaurus, was an ode to her lifelong love of fossil hunting, a passion she still pursues nearly every summer. Black publishes under the pen name Brian Switek. Her new book is called Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone, and it's just out in soft cover from Riverhead. Riley Black is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Riley Black, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by having you teach us a little bit about bone. I think many of us, as you assert in your book, do think of bones as rather boring and staid superstructures that our bodies hang on. But you make the case very elegantly that bones are quite dynamic. First of all, how many bones do we have in the human body?
So we don't know exactly how many bones are in your skeleton at any one time, which is kind of weird. You'd think it'd be standardized, right? But with about 206. And there are going to be some differences. For example, if you happen to lose a limb for some reason, you're going to lose a number of bones. But even if you have what we think of the full complement of bones, there's going to be some variations. So there are bones called wormian bones, which are these skull bones, these round, weird little puzzle pieces that are parts of the bones that we have when we're infants, when our skulls are first coming together. They don't fuse with the rest of the skull in the exact right way. Or sesamoid bones, these little bones that grow in tendons that you have on certain fingers and certain toes. For example, your kneecap is a big sesamoid bone, but you also have sesamoid bones on some of your fingers and toes, and they might be present in you, but not present in the next person you're related to or your friend or something else. So there's always a little bit of variation.
Yeah, I am always really interested in the sesamoid bones because I guess I like their name. It reminds me of sesame seeds or something, but you have a nice evolutionary explanation for their function. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, so it seems like it adds a bit of mechanical advantage that it makes moving around a little bit more efficient. They've evolved more than once. There's an entire research group right now at the Royal Veterinary College in England that are studying the origin and evolution of sesamoid bones, particularly kneecaps, because we don't have a ton of understanding yet about why they evolve so many times. But it seems that, you know, if you just do a basic experiment, there's a neat little video that they made showing this, where if you have almost two little pieces of wood, like the upper and lower parts of your leg, and a little like rubber band or something that help them move. It'll move it, but it won't move it very far or very powerfully. And sesamoid bones, which sit in the tendon right on your knee because it's your kneecap, seem to add a bit more power to that, for lack of a better term. It seems to allow more forceful movement, so you can run faster. Or in some animals, it contributes to like the stay mechanism that kind of locks in place, so you can stand still without having to expend a lot of energy or get like a muscle cramp or something like that. So we're still trying to understand how exactly these things first came about, but it's just such a simple little thing. It's like basic physics that you like learn in physics 101 that just adds so much to how organisms are able to move.
Well, now the subtitle of your book is The Secret Life of Bone. You know, we think of our bone as our skeleton as just being there. And of course, you point out it has lots of literary value. And of course, skulls have, it seems, inordinate value in terms of as symbolic value. And they've been used throughout the millennia as, bowls or drinking cups. But you make the point that our bones are actually quite dynamic as tissues. And could you tell us how that works? I mean, it sounds like our bones are constantly being remade. They don't just sort of grow and then that's it. I mean, they're in a dynamic flux.
Absolutely. It's kind of strange to think about if you just sit and think about what your bones are doing right now, that they're incredibly active. And you'd think that this would be something that's relatively intuitive because obviously we're not the same size or shape as we were when we were first born, that we, you know, we grow and our bones change and they coalesce and change from cartilage to bone and all those wonderful developmental things. But even just right now in this moment, you have certain cells in your bones that are taking up old bone material. Basically, if you imagine like these Pac-Man type cells that are eating up old bone tissue, just as new bone cells are laying down new bone tissue, new lattice work. So your bones are constantly turning over and recycling themselves and changing and responding to the environment, even taking up chemical signatures of the things that you eat and that you drink. And that's why we're able to tell something about historic personages and like fact check, like, okay, were they really in this region? Because we know this was a rainy area. Did their bones and the oxygen isotopes that are affected by rainwater reflect that? So all that really neat stuff from this, you know, basically this tissue, this organ system, that maybe we don't think about it the same way as like your heart or your liver or something like that, but it's just as responsive to the environment around you.
You also make the point, and a lot of the book is given over to evolution and really world, almost universal history, the history of the planet. And of course, many of us love the dinosaurs, and you spend some time teaching us about dinosaurs and fossils, but many other species as well. But I was interested to learn that even though I guess I've been taught to think of evolution as something that's so slow as to occur over thousands of years, you make the point that there is some evolution that seems to happen even amongst generations, for example, based on what we eat. And you sort of made that point earlier, but from one generation to the next, there's some change in our skeletons based on, you know, industrial agriculture, for example. How does that work? Do we know?
Absolutely. And it's kind of strange because we like to think of ourselves as kind of finished, like we're like this evolutionary endpoint. But the fact is that we're constantly evolving. Every time a new child is born, they're born with a new complement of genes, of a genetic background, of new biology that hasn't been seen before. And you know, if you accumulate those things over time, you can see the changes that we've gone through. In fact, we're evolving faster now based upon genetic research than in the past, like 100,000 years or so. Things like lactose tolerance, the ability to drink milk and digest it, is something that's relatively new and still spreading around the planet. So in terms of our bones, there's a lot of responsiveness to the things that we eat and the way that we move. In terms of the mechanics of evolution, like how our bodies are able to do this responsiveness over time, the work of natural selection, even though we have this cultural buffer against it. It really goes back to this idea that two scientists, Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould, came up with in the early 1980s called punctuate equilibrium, where if conditions are kind of the same, things are more or less going to stay in stasis, but maybe part of the population splits off and starts doing something different. You start to have an evolutionary pressure that gives an advantage to some individuals over others, and that affects how many offspring they leave and the attributes those offspring have. And it can go relatively quickly. So you start off with a population, you have this little segment that splits off, it can change relatively rapidly. And I want to make clear that this isn't like change that happens in the lifetime of an individual. It always requires reproduction, the next generation, you know, differential success in leaving offspring, all those things that we know from natural selection, but it can happen relatively quickly, and it is still happening in us.
Another thing that your book taught me is that you can't tell what race an individual was from their skeleton or from a sample bone from them. Now, you, in theory, I guess, could if you did a genetic analysis, but just grossly looking at the bone, you can't tell. But in fact, you go on to say that it's not even that easy to tell male from female skeletons. There are some clues, but if you don't have the full puzzle, it's really not that easy. Does that surprise your readers often?
I think somewhat, yeah, because we're so used to these categories as being so biologically innate, or we think that they are when in fact they're not. For example, race is entirely a cultural construct. There's no biological underpinning to race in the least. So at least when it comes to skeletons, the only thing that might possibly be listed as a racial marker sometimes, and it's still quite variable, is some populations in Asia have what we call shovel-shaped incisors, so incisor teeth that look kind of shovel-shaped. But even that isn't really a reliable marker. So when it comes to race, there's no biological underpinning for it whatsoever. And anthropology really started by trying to find these divisions, projecting that onto people. It's kind of like data. You know, when you put data into a computer program, if it's garbage in, it's garbage out. Well, they were starting from this racialized standpoint. So of course they found it, but when we look to what the bones actually say, it's not there. And in terms of sex and gender, this of course affects me pretty personally, whereas if somebody found my skeleton and they looked at my hip bones, the only bones are really anywhere near reliable for determining the sex of a skeleton are in the hip, basically these notches at the back of a hip that you can look at and get an idea, okay, was this more of a male person, more of a female person? But even that's variable. But even then, that doesn't reflect gender, because sex and gender are different things. I'm a transgender person. If somebody found my skeleton and said, okay, this is a male skeleton, so this must have been a man, they'd obviously be wrong. And if we're projecting that onto the past, when we find a skeleton, we say this is Cheddar Man or La Brea Woman or something like that, we can't talk to those individuals and find out what their thoughts about sex, gender, identity, all those things were. So there are some of these core concepts that we think are so apparent about ourselves, but our skeletons show that no, actually this is very variable and not as easy to pin down as we might think.
That's a really good point. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Riley Black, who's author of the book Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone, which is written under her pen name, Brian Switek. And it's just out in soft cover. And Riley, you were making the point about, for example, La Brea Woman, and that brings up the idea about the La Brea Tar Pits, which you write about. That's not the actual name. The actual name is something a little fancier now. But you, for this book, for the research for this book, you went to many of the places that study bone or collect bone. There are many of them all over the world, and certainly many of them in the United States. But I guess let's start with La Brea. What did you find there, and what would you expect to find there? And why in fact, do many people think of this skeleton as the La Brea Woman?
Right, so La Brea is one of my favorite places in the world. And the reason that I call it the La Brea Asphalt Seeps in the book is because if you translate the La Brea Tar Pits literally, La Brea means the tar, so it means like the tar pits. So they've actually made something of a push to say we should call it something else. But it's this site that records so much Ice Age history, and they've excavated it so diligently that even down to like beetle wings and bee nests. So it's not just saber-toothed cats and mammoths and the big stuff that, you know, might draw us into the museum. They have a really good idea of what these ecosystems were like over time. And in the excavations there, they've only ever found one human skeleton. And this was a person who seemed to have lived and died long after the Ice Age megafauna, or, you know, Smilodon and giant ground sloth and things like that, went extinct. It's unclear whether this was an intentional burial, whether this was an accident. There have been all sorts of ideas over time, but part of the reason I went to go see the skeleton was because each chapter of the book settles on a particular skeleton. So when I heard this name, La Brea Woman, I was like, okay, well, how do we know this? How is this identified? And using that as a kind of foil to talk about what we just mentioned on your show about, you know, how do you determine sex and gender based upon skeletons, and sometimes the mistakes that have been made historically about those things when storytelling kind of overtakes the actual identity of these skeletons. And I thought it was important to go and visit with these bones specifically and see as many of them as I possibly could, because we're talking about people. It's so easy to turn bones just into objects, to give them a specimen number and talk about them as if they weren't really people. It kind of dehumanizes them a little bit. So I wanted to be able to, you know, look these people in their eye sockets, for lack of any other alternative, and really kind of get to know them on their own terms, not just as a number in a book or in a research paper.
Yeah, and you taught many interesting anthropologic concepts. For example, one that I remember is gracilization. What does that mean?
Right, so there's an idea that in some organisms where you have what's called dimorphism, so basically at least two different forms. So if we look at like a modern-day olive baboon, for example, the males are a bit bigger, they're a bit taller, they've got longer canines, they look almost like a different animal versus the females. So that's called sexual dimorphism, and we call the male the robust form and the female the gracile form. Or sometimes people use that term gracile to refer to organisms that seem to have like a juvenile appearance. So like our dog, like I have a German Shepherd who makes a guest appearance in the book, and he's basically a big puppy. He's, you know, descended from gray wolves, but he's basically like a big gray wolf puppy. So in some parts of the anatomy have been, you know, have this gracile aspect evolved over time. So that's what that term means. It's generally, if you're looking at a comparison within a species between two different forms. There's often sort of a robust form and a gracile form. It's a relative way of sort of expressing that these are kind of what their anatomy looks like overall.
Thank you for that. Now, also, it seems like there's a lot of interest in bones and in medical history, shall we say, in Philadelphia. And I guess share with us a couple of the places you visited there and some of the findings.
Right. So the main reason I went to Philadelphia was to see the collection of a physician who was working, a couple centuries ago, Samuel Morton, because he collected this very famous collection of skulls at the beginning of the 19th century. And he was kind of a polymath of his era. He published on fossils and, anatomy and surgery and all those sorts of things. But the skull collection was the big thing, because early in American anthropology, the focus was this belief that there were about five different races of people. How do we divide them from each other? How do we identify them? How do we rank them? So it wasn't just a racialized science, it was a racist science. And Morton sent letters to his colleagues, friends, saying like, hey, if you have any human skulls, I'm trying to figure this out. Can you send them to me? And people start sending them in from all over the world. Now, when we look at this from a modern lens, there's all these kinds of issues of repatriation. Many of these skulls were stolen, or we don't know where they came from, or if the people who they once belonged to would have consented to this form of research. And it gets a lot more complicated. So I really wanted to visit Morton's collection to see how it's treated now and some of the questions that still surround it, basically the foundations of the science that now has to reckon with its past. That anthropology started as a racist science, and how do we escape those toxins that were inherent from the science from the beginning?
Yeah, I guess some of that was not new, but a lot of it was, and it goes fairly dark. Perhaps one of the more well-known anthropologic or archaeologic findings is the famed Australopithecus Lucy, who was discovered in East Africa. You have a nice chapter on Lucy and the significance of that finding. Can you share with us some teaching points about Lucy?
Absolutely. So Lucy is a really important fossil because at the time, not many partially complete ancient human skeletons were known. There are bits and pieces, and we had some decent specimens of our close relatives, the Neanderthals from Europe, and bits and pieces of Australopithecines from South Africa that were found decades before. But Lucy was a partial skeleton that gave us an idea of, like, this is the stature of the individual. This is what their hips look like. These are the proportions between the arms and the legs. And she was really important in that she's kind of this mosaic of features that if you look at Lucy's lower body, she's very similar to us, even though she's quite a bit shorter. There's a big toe that's mostly in line with the rest of the foot. There are hips that, when reconstructed, make this bowl shape, like good for holding like all the viscera and guts in, rather than these kind of hip blades that go over the back, like in a chimpanzee or a gorilla. So very much like a modern human from the waist down, not exactly like, different enough that we can tell that this is a prehistoric relative, but more similar to us. And when you look at our upper body, the rib cage kind of has this V shape. So like this big fermenting gut, similar to the digestive system of modern day gorillas. She's eating a lot of plants and things like that. There hadn't been the big move to carnivory yet. Lucy's arms are relatively long and her fingers are relatively curved, so she still would have been pretty good at moving around the trees. So this was, an ancient human right at this crux of this big change where our ancestors were moving around pretty regularly on the ground, standing upright, but still had a lot of these carryover traits from life in the trees. And it really sort of confirmed the pattern of human evolution, like what came first. So the ability to stand upright and walk upright on the ground came long before, our bigger brains and the more advanced forms of tool use and all that sort of stuff.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is author Riley Black, who has written a book called Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone, and publishes under the pen name Brian Sweetek. And Skeleton Keys really is an exploration of, history, culture, gender, and the science, really, of bones and anthropology. And it's really beautifully written. And Riley, I was wondering if you'd take us with at least one more great historical figure, because this is something that we learned about much more recently, which is the skeleton partial of Richard III, King Richard III. And remind us where those bones were found?
Yeah, so Richard III was thought to have been lost to history, that we have the historical record. We knew that he died at the Battle of Bosworth. You know, Shakespeare obviously had that very famous play, and you know, the movie adaptations, whether you prefer, you know, the Sir Laurence Olivier version or the Benedict Cumberbatch version. But we didn't have the body. We didn't really know what he was like in life. And this group of basically Richard III fans worked with archaeologists to think, okay, this might be a place where we might find something related to Richard III. And it was this old building that was buried beneath a car park in England. And early in excavations, they came across a relatively complete human skeleton. And that skeleton had clear signs of scoliosis. So this was a change to the vertebrae taking this curved shape that would have made this person's torso seem shorter than it was. And they started going like, could this possibly be Richard III? Because he was always described as being of a shorter stature or having a hunchback or something like that. And it turns out he doesn't have a hunchback. He's not, you know, kind of crouched over like in some of the media portrayals. But DNA evidence and other anatomical evidence confirmed that this was, in fact, Richard III. They had basically been buried in this spot, given a very simple and quick burial, and had been resting there under a car park for who knows how many years. And just by luck, they found him.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. It really is. And not this sort of glorious burial sarcophagus, I guess we've come to expect for royalty. One other thing you talked about in the book that was kind of interesting to me from a science buff viewpoint is there's been a lot of talk recently about a manned mission to Mars. And you seem pretty skeptical that our bones are going to be able to tolerate that. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so this is something that I was quite surprised to learn about, and it's something that we'd have to overcome. It might not be insurmountable because we know that some organisms are able to do this, but in zero gravity situations, our bones basically start to eat themselves. Remember at the beginning of our conversation where I mentioned that you have cells that are eating bone and laying down new bone at different rates and turning over your skeleton. For whatever reason, in zero gravity, there's not the same push and pull of muscles and ligaments and tendons on bone as there is on Earth. There's not as much stress on our bones, and we need that stress to keep them healthy. So over time, the bones will basically lose some of their density, lose some of their mass. It'll be much easier to break those bones. So I think, as I described in the book, like it might be if somebody eventually gets to Mars, they could, break their foot or break their leg just stepping onto the Martian surface if we don't find a way around this. The strange thing is that we know there are some animals where their bones should be breaking down, but they don't. Black bears, when they go into hibernation, they're not moving around, even though they're not in zero G. They're not, basically doing nothing other than sleeping, and yet their bones are maintained. Their bones aren't eating themselves, and this seems to do with some biological compounds that are in their bodies, and I know researchers are looking to them, saying maybe this is a solution. Maybe by studying hibernation of black bears, we can come up with a way to avoid this bone problem in our future astronauts. So it'll be very interesting to see like how that problem is eventually solved.
Yeah, and it gives rise to the idea of what we see in a lot of science fiction, where I guess if we were to be on a spaceship to Mars, we'd sort of go into a hibernating state, in theory anyway, or take perhaps some medication based on these biochemicals that bears seem to use to maintain their skeletons while they just hibernate. But you certainly could picture the old freezing tube or whatever while you're on your way there and back that would maintain your bone health. I want to turn to the fossil record because you spend a lot of time with fossils, and that's really a big part of your journalism and your work. There is this fossil that I had actually never heard of until I read your book. Pacaya is, I think, how you've taught me to say it. Tell us about Pacaya and what it represents in the fossil record.
Right, so Pacaya is one of my favorite fossils because it's just this unassuming little thing, and it's not an ancestor of ours, per se, but it's an animal that gives us an idea of what our ancestors were like about half a billion years ago during this time called the Cambrian Explosion, where animal life was really running riot in evolutionary sense. It's found in this famous shale deposit, the Burgess Shale of Canada. And if you go into those collections of Burgess Shale fossils, you're mostly going to find arthropods and vertebrates, a lot of worms, these strange creatures with compound eyes and shutter mouths and what we call raptorial appendages. And if you've ever seen John Carpenter's The Thing and all the stuff that like sprouts out of that space organism, that's kind of what the Cambrian looked like. And then there's Pacaya, and there's this little thing. It's a little squiggle. It's very, very tiny. And it just seems to be a tube with this little dark, basically stain running along its back. And that stain is a notochord. That's the very beginning of the spinal column. And that's really important because if you look at the traits that Makaya has, even though it's this unassuming little thing, it has bilateral symmetry, which means like the left side and the right side are the same. All the sensory organs that we can see are organized at the front of the body. They're not distributed throughout. So, you know, what it used for vision, for smell, for feeding and stuff, it's all bunched up at the front. Basically, it had a head, which is also important as this notochord running along the back. So the spine is at the back rather than at the front or some other arrangement. So this animal that lived in this environment with all these kind of weird things that might have eaten it really laid out the basis for our body plan. If you, you know, stick on a pair of arms and legs to an animal like Pacay, you more or less have what our body plan is. So without this animal, or if these animals went extinct, then, you know, either humans wouldn't have evolved or we'd look very, very different than we do now. So it's the small creature that's just so important for explaining how we got to be the way we are.
Yeah, and really interesting. And remind us how many millions of years ago this existed.
It's over 500 million years ago, about 515, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so I mean, way a long time ago, but a huge evolutionary step. Now, Riley, you, according to the bio I read, spend a little bit of time every summer, and I believe live or based in Utah now. And one of the reasons you chose to live there was because of the extensive fossil record in some of the, the areas around Utah, the dry deserty areas. And you spend a little bit of time on digs almost every summer, I guess not this summer because of COVID, but what's that like?
I mean, it's what I wanted to do ever since I was a little kid. The previous book before Skeleton Keys was called My Beloved Brontosaurus, and I talked about that a bit, and it's kind of my love letter to dinosaurs and fossils and field work. But it's really difficult work. It really is work. A lot of people come out, I think, and they expect to find, you know, like a T-Rex or something on day one. But generally, you're, you know, packing up with like a gallon of water, your snacks and food and sunscreen and all that stuff for the day, tools, this heavy backpack that you're going to, you know, try and start off at sunrise or maybe a little after so it doesn't get too hot. But, you know, it's hot and you'll get sunburned and bitten by bugs and exhausted and dehydrated and all that sort of stuff. But when you find the little crumbles of bone that tell you that there might be something in the rock, or you find a track or a footprint, which I've found a couple of times out here, is absolutely thrilling. Like being the first person to see this and wondering, okay, what kind of animal was this? How did it move? What did it look like? And that's really what inspired Skeleton Keys, in that I've spent much of my career writing about organisms like dinosaurs, like mammoths and Smilodon and things like that. Like, I've loved them since I was a kid, but I realized I didn't have a great understanding of our own skeletons. Like, you know, we're vertebrates too. Many of the same bones that you see in a triceratops, we also have. They're just a different shape. So this was sort of my attempt to dig into my own history, you know, take that love of fossils and dinosaurs that I got from field work and project that, you know, back onto ourselves.
Well, you did a really wonderful job. And I would say if you like narrative science and you like your history woven in with your science where you're going to learn a lot, then Skeleton Keys is an excellent book for you. The name is Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone, written under the pen name Brian Sweetek, and it's by my guest today, Riley Black. Riley, thank you so much for joining us.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Riley Black is the author of Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone, which is just out in softcover from Riverhead. She writes under the pen name Brian Sweetek. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.